So I got a question for you. I want you to think about your family, and on a scale from 1 to 10, please don't blurt this out for fear of embarrassing somebody. On a scale from 1 to 10, how awesome is your family? 1 being wah, wah, and 10 being yeah, right? Scale it. Think about it. 1 to 10. While you're thinking about that, I want to tell you a story of about a guy that had an awesome family. His name was Cornelius. You find his story in Acts chapter 10, and he had an awesome family. And so when you think about awesome family, what would you think about when you think about an awesome family? Any ideas?
Is that a question? Can I answer?
Yeah, please. Help me out here.
What's the question?
Oh, gosh. What are some characteristics of awesome family?
A beautiful wife.
You're just saying that because today's your wife's birthday and you're going to be very busy today. So, yeah. What are characteristics of awesome family?
United.
Love. Caring. What?
Fun.
Jesus. I heard somebody say Jesus. Yeah, the characteristics are wide and varied. And depending on who we are and where we're from and what our family was like growing up, we all have kind of a different interpretation of that. Well, this guy named Cornelius was a Roman soldier, and the Bible tells us that he was a centurion, which means he was responsible for about 100 men, and that he served in the Italian regiment, but that he was in Caesarea. Not Caesarea Philippi, but the other Caesarea, which is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And so, a little geographic description here. The Mediterranean Sea is kind of like this oblong submarine sandwich right here, and coming out of the number 12 would be Italy, which is where Cornelius was from. And it says he was in Caesarea, which is going to be over here about 4:30 or 5 o'clock on the other side of the Mediterranean Sea. And it says that Cornelius was there with all of his family, and that they were hanging out, and that they were on holiday, and that they were having a good time, and that Cornelius was generous, and that Cornelius prayed regularly. So there's a love of God there. There's a family component there. It's just a beautiful story of this particular component. You think about it. This guy's a Roman, right? The Romans were basically the slave owners of the people of Israel at this time. But somehow along the line, this guy had been converted, loved God, was generous, loved his family, brought them across from Italy to be on holiday. Now, if you take that story and you couple it with a story that comes out of the Old Testament, where a guy named Nehemiah has gone back to the city of Jerusalem, and the city's been decimated, and the wall's been crumbled, and Nehemiah's tasked with the responsibility of rebuilding the wall around the city, Nehemiah looks out and he sees the situation, and he sees all the possible things that can attack the awesome families that he's there to lead, and he makes this declaration. He says, look, don't worry about the enemies. Nehemiah chapter 4. He said, don't worry about the enemies, but instead, trust in the God who can protect them. Pray for your brothers. Pray for your sisters. Pray for your wives. Pray for your family. And then he says, and fight for your family. Well, how did Cornelius have this awesome family relationship? Well, Cornelius had to take Nehemiah's advice, and he had to fight for his family. Listen, awesome families don't happen by accident. You cannot accidentally have an awesome family. If your family is living by accident right now, your family is probably average at best. And so when I ask you to rank your family on an awesome scale, 1 being wah, wah, and 10 being yes, if your family ranking is somewhere less than a 7, you're probably not fighting hard enough for that family. And so how do you do that? How do you do that? Well, let me give you several things. First thing we want to talk about this morning, and you're going to like this one, because the first thing you have to do in order to fight for your family is that you have to strategize time in your family unit to have what, Lily?
Fun.
Fun. Caveat, not on Sunday morning. Just saying. And it's sad that I have to throw that in there, but I hear all the time, well, you know, Sunday's really the only day we have to be together as a family, and so we can't come. Let me give you the strongest theological word I know about that. Bologna. It's a very ancient Greek word. Your family should be a place where fun is kind of the order of the day. Cornelius was doing that. He'd gone to Caesarea with his whole family. They're hanging out. They're having holiday. They're enjoying each other's company. We need to schedule time to play in our families. You say, come on, Pastor, that ain't in the Bible nowhere. Well, let me draw your attention to Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 15. This is the New Living Translation. Solomon, who the New Testament refers to as the wisest person to ever live other than Jesus, says this, "So I recommend having fun." Told you. It's in the book. "Because there's nothing better for people in this world than to eat and drink and enjoy life." Solomon had to be Baptist and he had to be from Texas because Solomon is saying your life should include barbecue. That way, what? You will experience some happiness. The Lord wants us to have happy things in our life. He wants us to have happiness in our life. And then he says, it's important that you experience some happiness. Why? Because along the way, there's all kinds of hard work that God gives you under the sun. Sometimes life's hard. It's anxiety-filled. It's frustrating. And so if you don't prioritize the fun and playtime in your family structure, it is all toil and all parenting all the time. Ain't nobody got time for that. Ecclesiastes said, build in some fun. The New Testament tells us this, and I think it's interesting that Timothy speaks these words, because Timothy was a young man being discipled by an older guy named Paul. And Paul was trying to teach Timothy how to be a well-rounded pastor to his congregation. And Paul tells Timothy, your trust should be in God. Sounds like good advice from an older Christian to a younger Christian, does it not? And here's Paul's rationale. Your trust should be in God because it is He who richly gives us all we need for our what? Enjoyment. My friends, if you think Christianity is designed to be some kind of sour, dour experience, you have missed the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because God richly gives us all we need for our enjoyment. God wants you to enjoy life. The problem is we enjoy it to the exclusion of God. And that's where sin comes a problem. People don't remember so often what you say to them, but people will often remember how you make them feel. My daughter has a boyfriend, I'm sad to say. He's a good kid, and he loves Jesus, and he's really smart, and he has a great work ethic. Still my daughter. And his family is fun. And one of the things they have taught us is different ways to have fun. We grew up in Louisiana, and so when we grew up in Louisiana, you take the passage about getting together and eating and drinking and barbecuing and having a good time, you take that very seriously. People don't have garages in Louisiana, they have carports. And the reason they have carports is so that you can bring your family sofa out on the carport in the evening and everybody out there can see that you're all hanging out so that they can all come join you. It's just the culture I grew up in. And so everything we did revolved around sitting around eating and having a good time and telling stories and laughing and just giving each other a hard time is great. But what the Pugh family has taught us is that you can do that, but you can also play cards or board games or other kinds of things. And we would do that as a family, but we would like schedule a game night. Well, the Pughs don't do it that way. If you go to the Pugh's house for dinner, there will be cards involved at some point. If you go out to dinner with the Pughs after you place your order for your food, there will be a card game that will ensue on some level before your food ever gets there. Why? Because it's just a culture they built into their family. I knew one card game growing up, Old Maid. I never even was any good at Go Fish, but I did know Old Maid. They got a spreadsheet full of card games for 2 players or 3 players or 5 players or 6 players or 9 players. It doesn't matter the size of the crowd. we build fun into our family. And so I appreciate them not only for their friendship, but because they've just taken fun to a new level for us. It's important to have that. And when we're with them, we feel engaged. We feel wanted. We feel welcome. We feel invited into their card game culture. And it increases the connection. People don't remember what you say. They remember how you make them feel. So make people feel like your house and your family is enjoyable and pleasant and lighthearted and fun and that everybody's welcome. It teaches your children wonderful things. And it increases the awesomeness ranking in your household. Prioritize some fun in your life and family. Secondly, if you want to do battle for your family, not only do you have to prioritize fun things, but you also have to encourage growth. Each member of the family needs to be a lifelong learner, and those of you that are leading in the family, you must set the example as a lifelong learner. You say, well, but I'm single. That's all right. You still set the example by being a lifelong learner. It's doable. You just have to make the commitment to do it. Here's the caveat. You should help develop people in your family to accommodate their shape and their gifting, not yours. And this is where we run into trouble. We used to talk about the helicopter parent. Well, the helicopter parent has now been replaced with the lawnmower parent. And the helicopter parent is one who hovers over their children and never allows them the opportunity to breathe. The lawnmower parent is the parent that runs before their child and plows over and bulldozes over everything in front of them so that their children never have to make a decision, never are at risk, never have to take responsibility for anything, nothing. And that damages the kids and the family. But we think if we can take all of that for them that they'll never have to do it, we're woefully misguided. The other mistake we make is expecting them to be like us. Let me tell you a story. When I was in high school, I was the starting center on the JV team, and I loved it. There was something about hitting other people. There was something about groveling in the dirt. There was something about standing over somebody and going, stay down. There was just something about being a football player that rose up inside of me. I had all this aggression as a child and as a young man, and it helped me get it out, and I loved it. But halfway through my freshman year, the starting center on the varsity team got injured, and the backup was no good, and so they came to the freshman squad and the JV squad, and they said, Kevin, you're going to be the starting center for the remainder of the season. We made the playoffs that year, and I loved it. And then I grew up, and I got to manhood, and I had my firstborn, and he's a boy. And I told myself, I'm going to instill in him the nuances of the big man's game of football and what linemen do and how they hit people and how they stand over them and go, stay down. And so from the time he was little, I began to instill in him these things. And we began to wrestle and just testosterone-y stuff. And the day arrives when he is in junior high in the seventh grade and he's going to go out for the football team, and I'm dad's, it's good. And so I'm watching, and we're practicing, and they get ready, and they announce the lineup, and Seth made the B team. Oh, it's unacceptable. The B team? You know the B team stands for girls, right? And so I sat in the stands and I watched all season long while my son sat at the bench and drank the Gatorade on the B team. And so we practiced and I tried to teach him and gun and steal it and Eighth grade year rolls around and here it comes. He's gotten bigger, he's gotten taller, he's still not fast, bless his heart. But I'm thinking, and it's only eighth grade, we got time to massage this and so they have the first game, and I go, and I'm sitting in the stands, and I'm waiting for my boy to take the field, and he never does. And and I literally had a visceral reaction. And I was embarrassed to be the parent who sat in the stands because your kid played on the B team. I have since repented and I have confessed my sin. Get off me. And about two games into the season, I had to sit down and we had a conversation. I'm like, dude, do you like football? He said, Daddy, I like football a lot. And I said, what do you like about it? He said, man, the blocking schemes and the routes and the way you set up your defenses and your strategies for cover two. I'm like, no, I mean, do you like football? He's like, yeah, I like football. I said, do you like hitting people? He's like, well, it's okay. And I realized then that my son was a lover, not a fighter, and that he has no killer instinct when it comes to hitting somebody and standing over him and go, stay down. And then I had to have this really hard conversation with him. I said, tell me what you do love. Tell me what you do like. Doug, close your ears. My son says, Daddy, I really like the tuba. Father, say it ain't so. This is my boy. He's supposed to like football, not the tuba. And I said, what do you want to do with the tuba? He said, Daddy, I want to be the best tuba player I can be, and I want to use my leadership skills in the band to help the band be the best band that it can be. And when I go to high school, I want us to be able to go to some of these competitions that they keep talking about, and I want us to be able to march with pride, and I want to be... And so I decided in that moment that we were going to finish the football season because we have a rule in our family that if you start something, you see it to the end. You can adjust it at the end, but we're going to see it through to the end. And so we saw football through to the end, and I became band dad. And I sat and I watched them twirl and prance and blow and march and do all of those kind of things. And I cheered and I celebrated and I watched my son and then subsequently my daughter. And for 7 years, I was band dad. But I had to have that moment in my life where I came to the understanding that if I'm going to expect change in you, if I'm going to expect you to grow and mature and become your fullness, then I have to let you become you. And I can't force you to be me. I think one of the terrible mistakes that we make as parents is that we encourage growth, but you better grow into what I tell you to grow into. And I'm going to be honest with you, one of the most difficult responsibilities a parent has is know when to let go and know when to reel in. You want to talk about love being a battlefield? And you want to talk about waging war with yourself and subsequently sometimes waging war within the home instead of for the home? It comes at this point. We as grown-ups to fight for our family must encourage change. But we need to, encourage growth that the people in our family will grow and be the people that they are called to grow and be. I did a wedding last night, and every time I do a wedding, I always make them say the same thing. Every wedding I've ever done, I make at some point the bride look at the groom and the groom look at the bride and say, today I choose to stand behind you and encourage you to be the man or woman God encourages you and is leading you to do or be. I make them say that. Now, they don't remember because they don't remember anything that happens there. But I try to be a good pastor and I try to follow up and I try to mail them my notes from the ceremony so that they can go back and look at them later. Because I want them to know what they said. Jesus grew. He grew in wisdom. Luke 2:52 says that he grew in wisdom, which means he had intellectual and mental growth. He grew in stature. He grew physically. He took care of himself. He grew in favor with God. He had spiritual growth, and he grew in favor with man. He had social growth. You say, how do I know if I'm growing? Chad Karger, a longtime friend of mine, made this statement several years ago, and I think it's spot on, and I'll give you the biblical foundation for that. Chad Karger taught me years ago that the mark of a matured disciple, the mark of a disciple who is growing, is characterized by an increased capacity to love and to be loving. If you're in a state right now where your capacity to love and to be loving is in deficit, then you are not maturing as a disciple. And you say, give me the biblical litmus test for that. Well, this hotshot lawyer came to Jesus and he said, hey, I need you to tell me the greatest commandments. Jesus said, it's easy. There's two of them. Love. Love God. Love your children, or love your neighbor. And Jesus told this hotshot lawyer, that's the litmus test. It is your increased capacity to love. Does your spouse make you crazy? Are they the reason you can't get above a 5 on the awesome family scale? Maybe it's because you're not growing as a disciple and you don't have an increased capacity to love. Are your kids making you crazy? Maybe it's because you're not growing as a disciple and you don't have an increased capacity to love. Are your parents making you crazy, children, young people? Maybe it's because you are not growing as a disciple and you do not have an increased capacity to love and to be loving. The litmus test for our spiritual maturity is characterized by an increased capacity to love and to be loving. Jesus said there's two things you have to do. Love God first and foremost, and that spills over into your ability to be able to love others. We have to fight for that because it doesn't come easy. We also have to fight for supporting one another because we're better together. We're better together. This was already in my notes before I went to a conference this weekend, but I was using Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And Ecclesiastes chapter 4 says, two are better than one because there's a good return for their work. If one falls down, then the friend can help them up. But pity the one who falls down and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. And then it says, a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And that's a peculiar ending to that passage because it talks about two can do this, and 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 three is better. And so we have taught this passage, and we've hyper-spiritualized this passage by saying, well, it's two and two and two and three. Now we've interjected Jesus into the picture. And we were given a perspective this week that says, yeah, that might be workable. But maybe this is just simply the mathematics of multiplication and the mathematics of being better together. Two are better, two are better, two are better, but three is better than two. And if you go on, it says that a multitude is better than a few. Our families are designed to have impact in and around the culture. Our families are designed to make a difference. We know that one's not good because when God created all the animals and when God created Adam, Adam was looking around and he goes, man, everybody has their counterpart, but I don't. And God said, you know what? You're right. It is not good for you to be one. It's not good for you to be by yourself. And so God said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make you two. And so he gave him Eve. And then he said, we can expand this and we can make it better if you will be fruitful and multiply. And so two is better than one, three is better than two, and many are better than a few. That's kingdom math. That's kingdom math. Unfortunately, Jesus brings that all back to reality and says, but only a few are going to find it, which is why you need to be working on making the many. We're better together. Ecclesiastes says we're better together when people fall down. What causes us to fall down in the family? What are the things that trip us up in the family? What are the things that keep our family awesome scale from being below a 7? Well, let me give you three things. Number one, things change. Change is hard. Change is difficult, but change is coming. If you want to try to establish the status quo, and if you want to try to hang in and dig your heels in and not grow or not change, you're going to wind up in trouble because change comes. And so you need to be able to handle change when it comes in the family. Sometimes there's a big bump in the road. Dad gets laid off. A family member gets really sick. Grandma or grandpa die. A divorce happens. We have to work in the family to help stick together when things change. Secondly, we need to stick together and support one another when harmful ideas are introduced. And we really like to blame the world for this, right? Harmful ideas are introduced by the world. It's an evil place, and we need to protect our children from that. And I'm not against that. Please, don't misunderstand me. But let's make sure first that the harmful ideas that are entering into our family are not as a result of our own dysfunction. You with me? We need to do self-work first before we can do family work first. And that all starts with our relationship with Jesus Christ. But I'm amazed at how many times family tries to bring in harmful things into the family. My daughter turned 21 last Thursday, right? What happens when you turn 21? What's the law say now? She can drink. I can't tell you the number of texts or phone calls I got that said, hey, would it be all right if I took Tabitha out and bought her her first drink? And I'm like, no, it would not be all right. Relax, dude. I'm not going to relax. She made a choice on her own a long time ago not to participate in that stuff. Why would now all of a sudden, because the federal government says you can, you think I'm going to be okay with that? Why would you want to tempt her in that way? Why would you want to create an environment that says, hey, forget all the old fuddy-duddy people. The government says you can, so you should. Let me give you another really powerful, strong Greek word. Stupid. Don't be bringing that kind of stuff all up in your family. You are to fight for them. That's what Nehemiah said. Fight for them. When harmful ideas are introduced, they're going to come from the outside world. For God's sake, don't let them come from you. Did you see the Halloween video? Family couldn't be there. They had an emergency, and so they took their bag of candy and they poured it in this really nice bowl, and they set it out on the front porch. And a mom and a kid walked up, and the little kid takes his bag, and he starts doing this. And after about 4 handfuls, he turns around and walks off, and the mama grabs the kid by the back of the costume and drags him back up, and mama takes up the whole bucket, and she dumps it in the kid's sack, and then they throw the bucket down, and they run off the front porch. Don't be bringing that kind of stuff in your household. Don't be teaching your children and your grandchildren that kind of stuff. Do the right thing. Harmful stuff's already going to come. Don't be responsible for introducing those kind of ideas to them. We need to stick together because we're better than that. Harmful stuff's coming. But we also need to stick together because rejection is coming. This goes back to the lawnmower parent. Rejection is coming in work, in relationships, and social whims. The world's going to do all it can to reject members of your family. Don't let that rejection come from you. Don't let it come from you. It is a lifelong process. And you, when you withhold your love, or when you withhold your affection, or when you have to teach somebody a lesson by being passively aggressive and locking yourself in your man cave or your she shed just so you can make a point, what the point that you're making is that if you don't do what I tell you, then I reject you. And that stings for a really, really long time, well into adulthood. David writes in Psalm 71 some powerful words. He says, "And now, in my old age, don't set me aside. Don't abandon me when my strength is failing." And I think what David may be saying is, I didn't do a really good job of making sure we supported one another, and now I'm scared that you're going to give to me what I gave to some of you. You fight for your family when you support one another. Finally, you raise the awesomeness scale when you make Jesus the family's highest priority. You raise the awesomeness scale when you make Jesus the family's highest priority. That's the expectation everybody should follow. People fuss at me all the time and say, "You talk too much about your family." It's the only point of reference I have. And so if you're tired of hearing about my family, then turn this off for a minute. But in the context of my home, we would go home on Sunday afternoon and we would prosh the morning's worship service. Okay. And I would talk to my kids. And I would say things like, "How was church today?" It's not uncommon. Same answer I gave when I was in high school. Why was it just, I don't know, I didn't like the songs today. What about the songs that you don't like? This is not my style. I'm like, yeah, I get it. What would you do if I told you that it's not my style either? What? I said, "What is your style?" "Daddy, we like rap music." I'm like, "Rap music? No, Daddy, Christian rap music." I'm like, okay. There is a difference, by the way. And that's just kind of their generational thing. I said, "Yeah." I said, "I like big choirs. I like orchestras. I like hymns. I like that." "Oh, so you didn't like church either?" "No, I like church very much. Because church isn't about my likes or dislikes. Church is about my Jesus." And so we have these conversations and we embrace who we are, but we also embrace who they are. If good, honorable rap music inspires my children, then I will be happy to pay for an iTunes account for you so that you can download all of that kind of music that makes you happy. Make sure you make good choices with that music. But it did two things. First of all, it gave me the opportunity to encourage them to pursue the things that they like. Second thing, it gave me an opportunity to tell them that Jesus is superior to any biblical translation or any musical preference or anything that goes on like that. Jesus is why we gather. Jesus is why we do what we do. And so we fight for our family and we support one another. We make Jesus our highest priority. And we encourage each other to worship in ways that is meaningful. And so we gather in Jesus' presence. We gather to worship. We don't gather for music. We don't gather for fellowship. We don't gather for anything other than being in Jesus' presence. We gather to worship. We also need to make Jesus the highest priority in going in Jesus' name. We need to see our children and our family members need to see us telling the Jesus story. When was the last time you shared your faith? When was the last time you told somebody about the gospel? When was the last time you, in the presence of others, shared how Jesus changed you. If our family don't see us doing that, then they're going to assume that it's not important to us, and then it won't be important to them. We need to give Jesus our time, our talent, and our treasure. We need to participate in kingdom activity instead of making excuses for why we can't come to kingdom activity. Missed some band competitions in my day. My wife missed some band competitions in her day. Why? Because we had something going on here at church. My kid missed a couple of band competitions in her day. Why? Because we had something going on here at church, and it was important for the church body to gather in this place. It's frustrating to see parents say, you know what, my kid or my grandkid has an activity, and so I will put that in a priority over some kingdom activity. So here's the lesson that you teach your children or your grandchildren or your spouse or the people in your family. Kingdom stuff is good as long as it fits into the context of what my calendar says is doable. But if something the church is doing that's inconvenient or inconducive to my schedule, or if it interferes with your way of life, then we won't participate in kingdom activity. And so here's what you teach your children and your grandchildren. Kingdom activity is not nearly as important as you and your activity. Now, am I saying every week? No. But there are times when priorities matter. There are times when kingdom activity makes a difference. We need to give of our time and our talent and our treasure and participate in kingdom activity. And finally, we need to grow to be like Jesus. We need to mature in our faith. And if you claim the cause of Christ, then maturing in your faith is your bottom line, top shelf priority. You're supposed to mature in your faith. You want to raise your family awesome quotient? An awesome family starts with an awesome Jesus. And the scale increases as the people in the family love Jesus more and practice that together as a family. So let me ask you today, will you commit yourself first and then your family to Christ today? And will you do battle in love for your family? We serve an awesome God. He wants our families to be awesome.